So we've been in a series called The Story of the Bible. How many of you have been enjoying that series? Actually, if you haven't, don't say anything, because we've been doing this for a while, and we're not done. So we're actually at the point in this series where we're looking at two books, Ezra and Nehemiah. So I looked high and low for a book on Nehemiah that was not about the leadership principles of Nehemiah, that was not about like Nehemiah as CEO, Nehemiah as 21st century proto-pastor. I looked high and low for a book like that, and I actually couldn't find any book like that. Can you believe it? Books on Ezra and Nehemiah were mostly about here's what you can do to lead your church better. And I wasn't all that interested in it, because if you read Ezra and Nehemiah, you find out that Nehemiah, I mean, he's pretty admirable in his courage, in his dedication to prayer, but he's just another human being too. These readings of Nehemiah expose, as one of my favorite pastors and preachers, Tim Keller, says, the way that we actually think about the Bible. So we get to the Bible, and we are more prone to reading it like a manual, or like a handbook, or like some sort of glorified Aesop's fable, you know, or Aesop's fables. When we read the story, you get the moral. And while the Bible does tell us quite a bit about living the good life, that's not its primary purpose. Reading the Bible primarily for the moral of the story is like going to college to meet some new people and make some lifelong friends. It's going to happen, but if it's the primary purpose why you go to college, you'll not get very good grades. You probably waste a lot of money. So if that's not the way that we read the Bible, well, here's another way that we actually don't read the Bible, or we misread the Bible. Sometimes we take verses out of context. So earlier this year, we talked about this verse, Philippians 4:13, I can do everything through him who gives me strength. You remember that verse? We talked about how that is actually a challenge to the stoicism of the day and not actually about winning a football game. Now, here's another verse that gets taken out of context about 100% of the time. How many of you have heard this verse before? Without vision, the people perish. Anybody ever heard this verse before? So that means that if we don't actually have a business-style mission statement, then all the people are going to die. Is that what this means? Well, it's actually not what it means. What it means is if we don't have prophetic vision in the life of the community of God, then we are in big trouble. That's what it means, right? Here's another verse that we take out of context, maybe the most famous of all verses in the Bible. Perhaps you've taken this verse and you've used it as a talisman against evil. Jeremiah 29:11. How many of you know this verse? For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. This is probably one of the most famous verses in the Bible. How many of you are familiar with Jeremiah 29:11? Yeah, we're pretty familiar with it, right? But I want to say today that it's been lifted out of its context in most cases. We use Jeremiah 29:11 as kind of like an inspirational poster, sort of like a biblical fable, the tortoise and the hare, but the Bible version, right? I mean, I know it sounds ludicrous at face value, right? I mean, like, honestly, we do this to a whole host of other verses, not in the very least Jeremiah 29. We take these verses out of context. Whole books have been written using this tack. How many of you remember the prayer of Jabez? Any of you remember that? Enlarge my territory, God, you know? How many of you remember that? Well, today, what I'd like to do, I mean, we're in this Story of the Bible series, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to address this hermeneutical approach this morning. Taking verses maybe out of context. For I know the plans I have for you is a beautiful, expansive promise that has a context. It's a prophetic promise made to the Israelites in exile, as Bill Hannawalt talked about last week. And the context of the fulfillment of Jeremiah 29:11 is the story that we're going to tell today. It is the story for today, two books, Ezra, Nehemiah. We're going to talk about this context, and we're going to talk about how do we properly receive a promise like Jeremiah 29:11. Should we receive it? Is it wrong to receive it? I'm going to say no. But there's a way that we can receive it, and that's what I want to talk about today. So, you know, we've been in this story. We've been kind of patiently going, we've been really going through this like pretty rapidly, but we've been going through the story of the Bible. And because we are a people who have a story to a world that has lost its story, we have a story. And by the way, remember when I talked about the primary purpose of the Bible not actually being like a manual or a handbook for good living? Well, the primary purpose of the Bible is actually to tell that story, to tell the story of a loving God who is redeeming his good creation. We must know the story in our bones. We must know the story in our bodies, because this is where we believe all meaningful existence starts. All right, so that's why we've been telling the story. All right, so back to Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Well, where is this verse found? It's actually found in a letter to the exiles, okay? So it's found in a letter written by or delivered by the weeping prophet Jeremiah to the people of Israel in exile, as Bill talked about last week. So exile is something that the Israelites were desperately hoping to escape, right? They want to return to their land because the land is a visible sign of God's favor with them. And for them to be carried out of the land, away from the temple, meant actually desperation, despair. It meant hopelessness. And so they wanted to leave exile, and they wanted to return back to the land. But here Jeremiah delivers Jeremiah 29. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. This is very unexpected. So if you're sitting there and you're listening, you're thinking, that's not one of my favorite prophets, probably. But here's what Jeremiah 29 actually says. Verse 5, build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there. Do not decrease. Also, verse 7, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Yes, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Do not let the prophets and diviners among you deceive you. Do not listen to the dreams you encourage them to have. Oh gosh, there's so much to unpack here. They are prophesying lies to you in my name. I have not sent them, declares the Lord. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. And here is the verse we all know. Verse 11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. This is what Jeremiah 29 is about. Jeremiah 29 is a letter to a people in despair carried off into exile. It's a letter telling the people not to escape from exile, but telling them that they should not give up hope, that a return to Israel is coming, but they are told to be blessings to Babylon, right? To the foreign city that they occupy, which might sound familiar to you if you remember when we were talking about Abraham. A blessing to all nations. Now, they were thinking Babylon, well, these are our enemies. And now Jeremiah is saying, no. Pray for it. Seek the peace and prosperity of it. Because if it prospers, you will prosper, right? Don't give up hope. But let the thing that happens in you as you hear this promise, the divine imagination of the fulfillment of this promise, be the energizing impulse to turn your faces to Babylon and bring prosperity to them. And the Lord tells them 70 years. 70 years. Why 70 years? Well, a couple reasons. It essentially assures that every single person almost all the generation sent into exile would die there. 70 years, right? Their children would return, but not them. Those who left Israel more or less would never return. That's what 70 years is about, right? It's also to give the land 70 years of rest. Because the Israelites, of course, they did not give the land the rest that they were supposed to, as Joy talked about in her message a few weeks ago, right? So 70 years. So they spend 70 years in Babylon. Maybe the people of Israel listened to Jeremiah. Maybe they didn't. But as the 70 years comes to a close, this promise of Jeremiah 29 begins to come true. And this is where Ezra and Nehemiah, two books written together, begin. So Babylon falls. It's conquered by Cyrus, the king of Persia. He issues a decree. He's moved by the hidden left-handed power of God. And here's what Ezra 1 says. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. Verse 2. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and may their God be with them. And in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. So the book of Ezra is about the rebuilding of the temple. And guess what? Guess who pays for it? Persia pays for it. They don't pay for it out of their own pockets. Persia pays for it. I mean, can you imagine if you were a Persian at that time and you were thinking, wait, what? My silver and gold, goods and livestock, with free will offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. So the Lord is orchestrating the rebuilding of the temple. He's arranging for the Persians to pay for it. And here's something else. King Cyrus, Ezra 1:7, brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. So everything is being returned back to Israel. The central project of Ezra is returning back to Israel to rebuild the temple, the very symbol of God's presence with them. And there's some more bad news about that, but I won't talk about that right now, right? So plans to prosper, right? Plans to rebuild, plans to return. This promise is being fulfilled, right? And the plans to prosper also shot through Nehemiah. So a couple of Persian kings later, under Artaxerxes, Nehemiah sets about rebuilding the city. All right, so the central project of Ezra, rebuilding the temple, the central project of Nehemiah rebuilding the city, right? So the return from exile is actually happening in Nehemiah as well, right? And here's a little section from Nehemiah chapter 2. I said to the king, because Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? So the king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. And this, by the way, if you know the context, takes extraordinary courage to do. Because the king could just say, no, take him away. But he doesn't. So Nehemiah says, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take, and when will you get back? It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. And so then Nehemiah goes and begins to rebuild the city. This is a comeback story. How many of you like comeback stories? This is a comeback story. So they're carried off into exile for a variety of reasons, which we won't go into, and they're coming back. Plans to prosper and not to harm you, indeed. But hold on a second, because not actually all goes well. In fact, if you read Ezra and you read Nehemiah, they both end on very depressing notes. Ezra's book centers around a beautiful confession about intermarriage and how marriages have led them astray, right? So much like what happened with Solomon. But then comes the questionable action. So after they do this confession, all the elders of Israel come up to him and say, let's get like a divorce from all these women. So they basically put away their foreign wives. So if you read Ezra, basically Ezra ends with like a huge, large-scale divorce proceedings, which is not the way that you would think Jeremiah 29:11 would be fulfilled, right? I mean, like the end of Ezra. So what happens at the end of Ezra? Well, all these divorces happen at the end of Ezra. And what was actually happening here? Was this right to do? As one scholar puts it, and this is really important, the Jewish Bible does not ban marriage to all non-Israelites. And famous figures such as Joseph and Mary marry outside the community. The basis for unease about intermarriage is not ethnic. So if it's not about ethnic cleansing, then what is it about? Well, it's actually about worship, right? So they're actually maybe worried that if they stay in these intermarriages, sort of the set-apart character of Israel will no longer be intact, right? So that's what's happening here, right? But listen, if you read the end of Ezra carefully, you probably will come to the conclusion, maybe that wasn't such a good thing. All of those divorces. The same scholar again writes, perhaps there was no ideal action for Ezra to take. So breaking up the marriages was a horrific action, but simply accepting the practice of intermarriage would imperil the future of the community. Probably not the ending that we were hoping for when you look at Jeremiah 29:11. I mean, were you expecting the end of Ezra to end like that, right? Probably none of us were. And Nehemiah actually ends the same way, or it ends in a similar way. It doesn't end with hope. It ends actually with despair. So, and Nehemiah is the primary character displaying that despair. Like three times he has this like plaintive, sad note that we're going to talk about here for a moment, right? So Nehemiah 13, Ezra ends a certain way. Nehemiah 13 ends a certain way. Despite the people promising to not neglect the house of the Lord, here's the sad state of post-exilic Israel. They do neglect the house of the Lord. Basically, this is what Nehemiah says to the officials. Why is the house of God neglected? And then he says in verse 14, remember me for this, my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. In other words, I tried. Remember me, I tried. Right? And so then when it comes to the Sabbath, which they promised to keep, they're not doing that either. Nehemiah saw them working the land. He saw them trading wine presses. He saw them selling food. He saw them selling fish. He saw them selling merchandise. And the response again is, I tried. Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your great love. And here's the thing that happens at the end of Nehemiah 13. You remember what happened at the end of Ezra, right? So at the end of Ezra, they large-scale divorce proceedings, right? Well, the end of Nehemiah, what ends up happening? Here's what ends up happening. At the very end of the book, what Nehemiah records is the men of Judah marrying women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. In other words, we divorced them, and now we're taking them back. Or we divorced them, and now we're marrying others. Now we're intermarriage is at the end of this. So there's intermarriage and then there's a divorce at the end of Ezra, and then they're all marrying them back again at the end of Nehemiah. It made Nehemiah so furious that according to the text, he beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. Yikes. And so finally, a third time, Nehemiah says, remember me with favor, my God. And like the three times, the first one's pretty flowery, eloquent. The second time is a little less eloquent. The third time is like, I tried. So the Israelites, they return back to the land. Okay, so this is Jeremiah 29. They return back to the land. They return back on the dime of the empire. But rather than it being like a comeback story, it's like they don't ascend to the heights of David and the fictive heights of Solomon, they're lost. They're still living under Persian rule, and then they have continual battles with the people who are still in the land, and they slip back into sin and dissolution, and then following this, in the intertestamental period, which is like the end of the Old Testament to the beginning of the New, which is like 400 years, the land of Israel changes hands more than once. And it finally ends up under the hands of who, when we get to the New Testament? Rome. So what about this promise? Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have to prosper you, plans to give you hope in a future. Did it actually come true? Well, yes and no, right? I mean, it's yes in that the people of Israel actually made a return. That actually happened. But also no, or not yet, because it's pretty clear that Ezra and Nehemiah, where they end up, it's not the bright and vivid future imagined for the people of God, right? And by the way, this is the nature of a promise. So the nature of a promise is that it's not like a prediction. So a prediction comes true once. But a promise can be fulfilled over and over and over again, as the same scholar that I keep quoting puts it. Promise has the capacity to go on being fulfilled in ever-changing ways according to new circumstances, whereas prediction either comes true or it doesn't. Promise has elasticity and longevity. So the simple promises made at a wedding ceremony do not have to be revised and rewritten every few years as the life stages of a marriage roll along, right? They are phrased and intended to cover all eventualities and sustain a lifelong mutual commitment that will find practical expression in myriad ways, all right? So that's a really fancy way of saying, because promises are elastic and have longevity, that means that the promises of God are not null and void after one fulfillment. All right, this is really, really important, okay? So promises aren't predictions. So a prediction would actually, when it is fulfilled, it would actually be done. But a promise is not null and void after one fulfillment. Promises are fulfilled over and over again. This is, by the way, a very old and very familiar biblical principle. In seminary, my professors called it the concentric circles of fulfillment. All right? So the promises of Scripture get fulfilled in some measure right away, like this one, right? So they get back to the land. But then they get fulfilled again and again until they find their ultimate fulfillment at the end of time. And that's what's happening here in Jeremiah 29. And so now you're sitting here thinking, okay, so what, Ted? So what? So now we're here. That was a good story. What about me? Well, here's the thing. Here's where we come in. There's something actually really right about reading Jeremiah 29 and 11 and saying, I want that for me. When you look at Jeremiah 29:11 and you read that verse, it should call to you out of the text and say, yes, 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 that's for me. That is for me. There's something really right about that because it's not totally fulfilled yet. So when you look at Jeremiah 29:11 and you wield it in your hands, it should like call to you and say, yes, 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 apply it to your life. But without the context, and that's the whole reason why I just have been telling you this long story, without the context, we're prone to misapply it. We're prone to individualize it. We're prone to see it as predicting a certain kind of success or comfort in our near future. We hang it over our toilets. We go and go, remember, God has a plan to prosper and not harm you. And you sit down on the toilet and think, wait. But you know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, like, we use it almost like it almost lacks power because we think about it as something that just happens. Well, maybe this will happen next week or maybe this will happen tomorrow. But the Lord God is saying, no, this promise is for you right now. And it's not just to you, it's to the whole people of God. So how should we expect to receive Jeremiah 29? As this was a promise uttered to a people living in exile, guess what? Are we people who live in exile? This means yes. Yes, we are. We are people who live in exile. We are people who live in Babylon, as Bill talked about so eloquently last week. We live in the Babylon of America, where there are ideological gods like consumerism, materialism, you know? We live in that kind of Babylon, and so what are we to do? Maybe what it means for us to take Jeremiah 29 is not just to take verse 11, but all of it. To take all of it. What if the word for you and me right now is to take Jeremiah 29 and seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which we have been carried into exile? What if what Jeremiah 29 means for us is that we are supposed to pray for our city? What if Jeremiah 29 means for us that if it prospers, our city prospers, we will prosper? What if being a Jeremiah 29 people means that we are under a promise that gives us hope for a future, but gives us the kind of divine imagination that energizes the present so that we can live out the calling our father Abraham has for us, which is to be a blessing. Remember Abraham, a blessing to all the nations around you. What if that's what Jeremiah 29 means for you and me? What if the most important part of Jeremiah 29 is to seek the peace and prosperity of the city? What if that's what it means for us right now? What if that's why Jesus said, I pray that you pray not that you take them out of the world? What if that's why he's praying? Because Jeremiah 29 is still being fulfilled in you and me. A couple weeks ago, I had lunch with a man named Michael Allen. So Michael Allen leads an organization called Together Chicago. I don't know if you've heard of Together Chicago. Have any of you heard of Together Chicago? Yeah. So Michael and I crossed paths in seminary. So we sat across each other at Dengio's, and I'm like, I think I recognize you. And he's like, I don't recognize you at all, which shows you about my ignominious time in seminary. Anyway, we crossed paths in seminary while Michael was leading actually Uptown Baptist Church. There was a shooting that happened on the front stoop of the church. And so he went out as blood was pooling underneath the body, and he said, something must change. And so he started an organization to end gun violence in the city of Chicago. It started like as a fledgling group, but now it employs over 30 people. Change is happening through Michael Allen. So in all of the initiatives that Together Chicago actually does in neighborhoods, it's demonstrable in terms of statistics, in terms of the prosperity and the peace of the neighborhood that they are in. It's like super demonstrable. And all five of their initiatives are being enacted. Something, change is actually happening. And how is it happening? It's happening through an exile. It's happening through an exile who lives in Babylon, who seeks the peace and prosperity of Babylon. Like, we just took our benevolence offering today. Why did we take it? Well, because we're Jeremiah 29 people. That's why we took it. Because we're here to seek the peace and prosperity of the city of Chicago. That's why we took it, right? I mean, that's the animating principle behind the care center and the food pantry. We like all of that. Like Christina is here. The animating principle behind it is to seek the peace and prosperity of Chicagoland, right, Christina? That's why we do it. But I guess the question to you is, what about you? Think about your neighborhood or your city. Are you a Jeremiah 29 person in your neighborhood or city? I mean, do you seek the peace and prosperity of, say, the North Park neighborhood? This 60202, as we like to call it here. In our staff, I'm going to let you infer from that what you might. Or what about Skokie? Or what about the neighborhood that you live in, like West Ridge or Rogers Park? I mean, do you seek the peace and prosperity of your neighborhood? When was the last time you prayed for your neighborhood? And like, what are you noticing in your neighborhood that could use the wise and patient influence of Jesus? Because that's what it means to live into the promise of Jeremiah 29:11. Did you know that? There are plans that God has for us, but he also has plans for you and me to enact on the neighborhoods and the cities that we are in. And those plans are to prosper and to give peace to the cities that we are in. You know, like Bill talked last week about adding to our spiritual practices, casting out fear, right? So anytime we talk to somebody who's fearful, we pray for them. Well, what if you add to that practice doing something for your neighborhood? I mean, even picking up trash off the sidewalk. I think what Jeremiah is saying is when you do that in your city, you are sitting in the will of God. Peace and prosperity of your city. That's what Jeremiah 29 means. If you want to like apply Jeremiah 29:11 to your lives, what about all of Jeremiah 29? And here's the other thing about knowing the context of this promise. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you, not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. So one of the ways that we misread Jeremiah 29:11 is that we think, okay, well, God means for no harm to come to us, or his plans, no harmful plans, so that means that no harm is going to come to me at all, right? No harm is going to... I mean, how many of you have maybe read 29:11 to read, like, if I hold on to this promise, that means that he will protect me. That means that no harm will come to me. That means nothing bad will happen to me. How many of you, like, live that kind of gospel? I think I do. Like, I'm thinking, man, I am a good dude, I think. I mean, like, depending on the day or depending on the hour, I'm a good dude, right? And so that means that because I'm a good dude and I believe in you, Jesus, that you should protect me at all costs from everything. I pray, like, almost with anxiety about protection all the time. Don't we do that? I don't know. Well, that's one way that I sort of misread this verse. But that's not what this verse is actually saying. This verse is actually saying that God's plans for us are not to harm us. And we can trust that God. We can trust that God. But how many of you know there is a prince of this world? How many of you know there is an enemy? And how many of you know that his plans, if Jeremiah 29 were written like from the lens of the enemy, it would be plans to accuse us, plans to harm us, plans to oppose us? So if you know the context of Jeremiah 29, that you actually know the context of the fulfillment of it, you know that in Ezra and Nehemiah, they experienced a lot of harm and opposition, didn't they? How many of you know that? I mean, reading Ezra and Nehemiah, you know that they, when they went back to rebuild the temple, it wasn't almost like, oh, conquering heroes, come back. This is wonderful. Yes, the temple. Yes, the city. No, that's not what happened. Ezra 4, then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. Opposition, right? And then Nehemiah, but when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the people of Ashdod, by the way, the Ammonites and the people of Ashdod, these are the people that the men of Judah married later at the end of Nehemiah. Anyway, heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry. So many of us are familiar, if we've been in the church, with that picture of Nehemiah and the people with Nehemiah actually building with one hand and holding a sword with another. How many of you are familiar with that metaphor, that image, right? We are familiar with that. This is what happens, by the way, to people under the promise. Opposition. Remember the words of Jesus, probably the least famous beatitude. Blessed are you when people insult you, when they persecute you, when they falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Remember that one? Try not to, right? Or if they hated me, they will hate you also. Well, did they hate Jesus? Well, they sure did. They hated him so much, they killed him. In fact, I mean, I think that one of the things you can say is that if you're living in the promise of Jeremiah 29 and you're not experiencing opposition, then maybe you're not actually living into the promise. I mean, every great saint I know has experienced opposition to their work. Every single one. When the Vineyard movement of churches was first established, there was opposition, even from other Christians from different streams and denominations. I mean, they put out these radio shows about how Vineyard is definitely a cult. They do that. I know we laugh at it today, but that was the climate in which I went to seminary. I mean, Steve remembers this, right? I remember Steve, we had so many Vineyard people at Trinity at the time. I remember that I asked Steve, like, Steve, could you come and do a Vineyard polity class? And they didn't let him do it on site because they were like, no, too controversial. And we're like, what? So we had to do it in Steve's office. You remember that? All of us crammed in there, seminary students, tell us the history of the Vineyard. I remember leading worship in one of the classes at like seminary and the professor standing at the door on watch, like worried that a professor would come by and go, glorifying God, get out of here, right? So we had opposition, right? And yeah, think about the purchase of this building. How many of you were here for all the opposition because of the purchase of this building? How many of you? Well, many of you were actually here. And even in my own personal life, as I reach for the promises of God and try to faithfully live out my vocation, I faced opposition. My house is my enemy. I mean, we had so many problems with our house that it can't be sheer bad luck, right? I mean, it feels like opposition by an enemy against us. And so my question to you, people of the promise, will you let a little opposition stop you from having hope? Please do not. Please do not. Please do not. The opposition is a sign that you're living into the promise. The opposition is a sign that you're living in the promise. The opposition is a sign that God's favor is on you, not that his favor has departed from you. So if you have opposition in your life, good news. Good news. The devil means to destroy you. The devil means to accuse you. The devil means to vilify you, to say falsely say all kinds of evil against you. The devil means for those to be the plans against you, but take heart because Jesus has overcome the world. And we too, like Ezra and Nehemiah, we wait for our return from exile, when we get to go back to our holy city, not Jerusalem, but the new Jerusalem. And so we too are like exiles, just waiting to go back to our true heavenly home. We too, like exiles, are just waiting to get back to our true heavenly home. And are you going to let a little opposition stop you from hope? Please do not. For the plans that God has for us are to prosper us. And as sure as he made true on his word to save and redeem us, he will make true on his word to do that too. So meanwhile, as we are here, we can seek the peace and we can seek the prosperity of our city.